Welcome to MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex. With me is James.
Hello, all.
Just before we get started, we would like to get you to check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. We've got a lot of content up there. I think this is our 105th episode, mm-hmm. So we have 104 other podcasts for you to check out.
At least.
Well, yeah, plus minisodes, I guess. Remember minisodes? Good times. And James recently wrote something about fantasy football and fragmentation. I believe that is the exact title, but it's good. I recommend you check it out, as opposed to the other slop and filth we publish on our website. Check out what
those are. That's what those articles are called.
Yeah, too. Exactly. Slop and filth. It's slop and filth.
I wrote slop. Alex did filth.
It was a team effort. Last week, we did a podcast on Ghostbusters, which I know you've all seen. And if you haven't, you're the worst. But today we're going to do a podcast on another movie that I hope you've all seen. And we'll just get right to it.
Welcome to The MacGuffin Men. This episode is brought to you by Eternal Sunshine, a movie you've definitely seen. If you think you haven't, it just means that you saw it with a date who eventually broke your heart. And now, here are Alex and James.
So you like that theme song?
Yeah, I'm a fan.
You know what you don't like?
What?
Children.
Yep, that's true. I was wondering how you would work this in.
Go with me on this.
Yep, I'm going.
Okay, so you know how you hate kids?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. What would it take for you to spend, like, lots of time with one? Like, most of a few years consecutively.
Now, am I... Like, is this a babysitting relationship? Or is this, like, this is a kid that I own and whose ass I have to wipe and stuff?
I don't think you're supposed to own kids.
Okay, well, that I am the legal guardian of and have to, you know, clean up his messes or her messes.
Yes.
How much would it take? Like, money?
Yeah. Just in general, what would it take, do you think?
Everything, I think. No, I would... Just the prospect of that makes me very uncomfortable. How old is this kid?
Like zero.
Oh, God, no.
But only to start.
Like, I would have to be financially set for the rest of my life when these 3 years are done. Because okay. I want no part of a baby.
Okay. Well, you get the whole baby.
That's so many parts.
It's only one, really. Well, I'm going to tell you what the correct answer is.
Okay.
You ready for it?
Yes.
It's a cute one.
Okay.
Love. You would have to love this baby in order for you to deal with it for any amount of time.
Yeah, fair enough.
And I swear it's all going to come together.
Yeah, they sometimes do.
So I was doing some reading on this very topic of you babysitting children.
Okay.
And evolutionary psychologists and biologists and stuff, I've been trying to figure out like a scientific explanation for love for a really long time.
Because
it's been around forever and it's still kind of, you know, ethereal and misunderstood.
Yeah.
And they think it's something that animals came up with to be able to tolerate their mates in children long enough to keep their species going.
Okay.
As cold and bad as that sounds.
Yeah.
That's kind of the function for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. It's a really interesting subject for me because it's where kind of like something is cold and hard and empirical science overlaps with something as, you know, poetic and mysterious as emotion and love and things like
that. Yeah. And like very often illogical, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, for someone like you who doesn't really have any interest in spending any time with a kid to be able to put up with it for years and years, our species would need something like love in order to propagate the species.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so the movie we're talking about today is something that is a movie that deals with kind of that intersection between science and love and neurology and affection. And that movie is Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Yes. We got there.
We got there.
Yeah.
Thanks for going with me on that.
Yeah.
A movie you like.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. A movie I like as well.
Yeah.
And I think a movie with you know, a lot of stuff to talk about.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. This movie does not lack things.
Yes. So, I don't know. We'll get right to it. It's a 2004 movie directed by Michel Gondry.
Correct.
And written by Charlie Kaufman.
Yes. The story was co-written with Michel Gondry and another writer as well.
Yes. And conceived by...
An old writing partner of Charlie Kaufman's, who's an artist who, like, sort of... made one of those cards, like, this person has erased this person, because so please never mention them, made that as like a piece, and then that became the bouncing off point for the movie, I think.
Yeah, and then it just kind of gets extrapolated from there, and we kind of get the whole movie's, you know, it's got a narrative and everything, but it's kind of just exploring that idea.
Yeah.
And this was a very well received movie by critics all around the world, pretty much.
Yes, exactly.
It won Best Original Screenplay at the Academy Awards and tons of other awards around the world. Yeah. And the screenplay was kind of the biggest thing about this. And people do like it altogether. And we'll talk about the visual style, which I think gets a lot of appreciation as well. But I think it was just one of those really good screenplays with, as you said, an interesting idea. And took someone like Charlie Kaufman and, you know, Michel Gondry and that other writer to, you know... bring it to life.
Yeah.
Whatever that guy was.
Yeah, exactly. Who gives a fuck? I'm sorry. I'm sorry, third writer.
Talented writer whose name is not worth remembering.
Well, what's your fucking suggestion, Carrie? Do I write down all of the names of the writers of these movies?
I'm not overstating how much critical love this gets, right?
I don't think so. Okay. I'm sort of removed from the critical love for this movie because this movie came out right around the time where I was started my phase of just never trusting a movie critic. So I didn't, and this was like when I would just fully ignore a critic's opinions as well. And I definitely loved it. And so I can't say from like being in the times, I actually forgot it won the best screenplay Oscar until you just said that.
Okay.
But I definitely knew that happened at some point. But yeah, no, I feel like it got a lot of love, and I feel deservedly so. But
okay. And so you saw this in theaters right when it came out?
Yeah. This is one of two movies that I have seen three consecutive days in theaters.
Wow. What's the other one?
it's going to make you laugh. The Confidence, starring Edward Burns, Dustin Hoffman, and Rachel Weisz. Nobody else has ever seen it.
Wow.
Like, the only people I've ever met that have seen that movie are the people I saw it with on those days.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it didn't receive quite as much critical love as The Confidence.
Just Confidence. There's no the. Oh,
okay. Yeah.
Test screenings, they proved that the preposition was unnecessary.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, I was really late to this movie, and it was one that got built up a lot for me, and people said I would really, really like. Mm-hmm. And then I saw, and initially, like, I was already kind of apprehensive about it just because of how much it had been built up.
Yep. No, I remember talking to you just before and just after you watched it for the first time.
Yeah, and I don't like the beginning of this movie.
Okay.
Very much. And by beginning, I mean the first few minutes. So my hopes are really high and then daft immediately, which is, I think, really good in the long term because it kind of, you know, evened out my hopes for it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
The whole Valentine's Day little spiel at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Not crazy about and think has been done a million times. And Jim Carrey's kind of sad voice is, I don't know, at the start is just a little thick for me.
Okay.
But I quickly do enjoy this movie, you know, rewatching it, but I remember that being something where it really deflated my overly stuffed expectations for it.
Mm-hmm.
And this I think was good.
This is something I've sort of thought about a little bit in the wake of your saying you didn't love Eternal Sunshine, is that I feel like part of it is that your love of Charlie Kaufman, and this is sort of the least, I don't know, it's a very Charlie Kaufman movie, but not the things you would necessarily love about Charlie Kaufman, you know, like it's his least funny movie except for Synecdoche, New York.
I think the first 15 minutes of Synecdoche, New York is like the funniest 15 minutes of like consecutive of Charlie Kaufman, though.
I would mostly agree with that. I feel like there's a section in Being John Malkovich that I would probably find funnier, but
yeah, okay, you might be right,
but yes, but yeah, and this is Synecdoche, like for the first 40 minutes is pretty funny, and then there aren't a lot of jokes for the rest of it. But yeah, no, and I think you like, I don't know, the type of comedy that Charlie Kaufman wrote, and this is sort of the most, I guess you could say, like purely emotional movie that he's written, less dealing with the sort of more analytic stuff that we get in Adaptation, and being John Malkovich. So that was sort of always my take on why you like this less than most Charlie Kaufman movies. And I feel like, as a appreciating screenplays, I feel like this is my least favorite Charlie Kaufman screenplay, but this is my favorite movie that Charlie Kaufman has written.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hmm. All right. Well, let's get right to the actual contents of the movie. And
yes.
We can kind of talk more about bigger picture stuff.
Yeah, I have a line that we can sum it up with. This is a new thing I'm going to start on the internet. It's movie blurbs for like DVD covers, but they're written by douchey film critics. it's Annie Hall for a post-Memento world. That's what the critics are calling it.
Okay.
Those critics being me.
Yes. Admittedly douchey.
Yes. Admittedly. Okay. So.
Good.
I do think that is a really good way to sum up this movie.
Yeah, I had some Annie Hall stuff in my notes here. I didn't think Memento, but yes, after hearing that, that certainly does make a lot of sense.
Yeah. I feel like this movie got so much easier to greenlight after Memento came out.
Yeah.
Because Memento comes out in 99 or 2000, and this movie, like, this was an idea that Charlie Kaufman and Michel Gondry had had since like 98, had been bouncing it around, and I mean, not that it was, I know it was in a finished form or anything, but I'm sure money came much easier to come by once Memento became sort of accepted by at least a small, you know, enough of an audience to make back a $20 million investment, you know?
Yeah, and it's not a very expensive movie, and Memento, yeah, I think kind of says we can tell a non-linear story, and I mean, we have Pulp Fiction and things like that, but this is more bouncing around than just separate streamlines, you know?
Yeah, and it's also very much, like, as far as the Clementine and Joel story, it's almost entirely in reverse, and we just sort of get these interludes with the Lacuna Inc. people, so.
Yeah.
And modern Clem, I guess. Present day Clem.
Yeah, it is a tough one to explain, and there is kind of them, the reverse storyline of them, of their relationship, and then once we start plugging present day people into memories and things like that, I think it just gets beyond really trying to explain the chronology of.
Oh yeah.
Yes. Well, let's talk about Clem and Joel then.
Okay.
Because that's a good starting point. And, you know, with their first interaction when he heads to Montauk and they meet each other on the train.
Yeah, but they see each other on the beach and then in the diner and then talk to each other on the train. One thing I like the intro to this movie a lot more than you do, like the first couple minutes. But I think my enjoyment is almost entirely aesthetic more than the actual writing that you like, which I do think is kind of a bit hackneyed and all that. But just the way the opening is put together, just him running to catch that train, and there's this really weird shot, the shot from above that I like, and just the way that intro is put together, I like a lot. But when she waves at him on the... when they're both waiting for the train and she's out of focus and like further down and she's the only person waiting for this train other than him, and he's like trying to get away from her and she like leans back and waves. I love that so much. I have no idea why. I always like appreciate when a movie tries to get a laugh, or I guess that's more of a chuckle, but don't bother to put that in focus. I always like that. Like there was a moment in Silver Linings Playbook that I saw recently where the joke is just entirely out of focus. And I love it when movies do that.
But. Yeah. And I think in this, especially, Joel is so introverted and self-involved, not in a, self-centered kind of way, but just so concerned with himself, that I think it really works that she's out of focus. I mean, he doesn't want to look at other things. He doesn't want to kind of see himself in relation things. I think he's just so inward looking that I think it's perfect that she's out of focus, and you know exactly who it is and exactly what she's doing. And, you know, you can almost see the smile on her face when she does that kind of lean back thing to go to the first side. I think that's perfect for the characters. So at this point in the movie, we don't really know much about Joel just because it's so early on, and we don't really know anything about Clem because we've seen her as a out of focus character who has done nothing else by this point.
We know she likes orange, though, because you have to like orange to wear an orange sweater out.
Yes. But, I mean, after rewatching this and getting to know their characters a bit more and the way that they interact throughout the movie, it's kind of, I don't know. I don't think Clem is a very likable character. But I see the attraction. I mean, it's, you know, as classic as opposites attract, but she's less likable than she is more of an antidote for Joel's problems.
Yeah,
of being so introverted and, you know, only focusing on himself and things like that. And the way that she kind of follows him and goes to the other side of the platform and then leans back to, over to the other one, is kind of making herself be seen and making Joel deal with her, which sounds a lot worse than it is, but kind of like forcing this issue, even if it's just herself, on him. It really sums up their relationship in like a couple small movements. And, you know, she's out of focus, she's not talking, but I just thought it was a pretty succinct way to sum up the dynamic of the relationship we're about to see between them.
I agree 100%. And yes, I agree that I don't find Clementine a very likable character. I don't find Joel a very likable character. I always feel like I don't get very emotional watching this movie. Like, I love it, but I don't find the emotion really hits me. But I worry about how emotional this movie would make me if I actually cared about these characters. because everything else about this movie works for me perfectly, except for, like, I just don't care about the characters. And I don't think that's necessarily a fault of the movie. I actually feel like it almost works better that I don't care about them, because it sort of leaves room to think about my own opinion on the things that are going on in the movie, as opposed to worrying about theirs. I agree. I don't think either of them are particularly likable characters. How do you feel about Joel?
I think Joel is less, I don't know, I'd say more likable than Clem. Clem bugged me. Clem seems mentally unhealthy.
She is also the type of character you wouldn't like. You just never like this type of character.
How so? What do you mean, this kind of character?
I don't know. It always feels, I feel like sometimes, and this is going to sound mean, I feel like sometimes you're harder on female characters than you should be. And I think,
it's females in general.
Well,
it's not a character.
Just a big woman hater. No, it's just like, I feel like, I don't know. I feel like you are harder on women characters in movies than you are on men. And I don't have a reason for why I think this. I just sort of do. I think a big part of it is that you feel like, the male characters in most of the movies I'm thinking of are more realistic or something like that. And, that's typically true. I feel like you're more likely to meet a Joel than you are to meet a Clementine. You know, a person named Clementine. But I think a big part of that happens to come from the majority of movies just being written by men. And that's a big thing. That's just sort of, I don't find this just in you. I feel like a lot of people that are sort of hard on female characters, it's sort of just a difference in realism, because I mean, it's not hard to see a lot of things we've learned about Charlie Kaufman in other movies in Joel. Whereas Clementine is more based out of entirely his mind, or, I mean, you know, I don't know, could be based on somebody he knows. But it's, Joel is more Charlie Kaufman and Clem is more his perception of other things. And so the former will always feel more realistic than the latter and more authentic. And typically people you can't imagine, you probably wouldn't enjoy, like, you can't, you know, realistically imagine you wouldn't enjoy hanging out with. And if you wouldn't enjoy hanging out with a character, typically you wouldn't like a character. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no. And that's fair, because as even as I tried to explain why I like Joel a little more, he's certainly not that mentally healthy either.
No, absolutely not.
And has some problems of his own. I guess Clementine, I think, is more obviously outwardly problematic for the people around her. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think if you were in a relationship with Joel, just because he doesn't, you know, yell at you and get drunk and break your car, doesn't mean he's good for you.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? It's just more of a very obvious, I don't know, a very clear example of an unhealthy person. Whereas I think you'd have to spend more time with Joel and you'd have to get in a relationship with Joel for him to have a negative impact on your life.
Yeah.
And I think it's in Funny People where they say, just because you don't yell doesn't mean you're not mean.
Yeah.
No, I think it's totally that. Whereas he could be just as detrimental to your personality if you spent a long time with him. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, Clem hurts Joel's feelings within a few minutes of speaking to him.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Whereas,
and then hurts Joel's... his shoulder shortly after.
Exactly. Whereas I think Joel would be more careful not to do that immediately, but maybe by the nature of his personality, it would happen anyway.
Yeah.
And when I say maybe, I mean most certainly.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I feel like just to sum up our sort of joint feelings on what we've been talking about, I feel like Clementine is sort of the worst manifestation of the Manic Pixie Dream Girl, and Joel is the worst manifestation of the sort of artistic quiet male.
Yeah, the tortured artist.
Yeah. Yeah. That the writer is also putting himself in, very obviously, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And these are two stereotypes that are very easy to be grating, and aren't necessarily grating in this movie, but aren't likable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's right.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I think just being a male, I'm going to have an easier time sympathizing with the male character.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I'm sure the problems could be equal, but it's easier to put yourself in those shoes.
Exactly.
Yeah. It is... Yeah, no, I think it is kind of interesting that neither of them are very likable characters, because I think this movie, I mean, do you want to try to define this movie by a genre? Is it sci-fi romance?
See, a lot of my favorite science fiction movies are have
borderline science fiction movies.
No. Well, yeah, that's true. But I mean, a lot of my favorite science fiction movies, like I'm thinking of The Fountain here, are kind of also romance movies, but just sort of more hard sci-fi. Like, I definitely think Eternal Sunshine is a sci-fi movie. Just think it, you know, it doesn't put you in Blade Runner's world. It's just sort of, it exists in our world entirely. It's just also, you know, we're dealing with a lot more internal thought. We're dealing with memory. We're in our world primarily, but we're also in Joel's head for a lot of it. And
that's where the science comes in.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And so you'd say sci-fi romance. I mean, I know that's a tough one, and genres are so fluid that it's, you know, impossible to ever say for sure. But it's a romance movie that I don't know if it leaves you with a good opinion on romance. And I think a lot of romantic movies, you know, end happily and say, like, these people will get together. Or in the case of something like 500 Days of Summer, you know, which we also did a podcast about, I think we kind of concluded that, I forget his name now, Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character?
Tom.
Tom. Will be happy one day, but not with Summer.
Yes. And that's what's awesome about 500 Days of Summer.
Yes, but it also says, you know, romance works, love works, just it didn't work this time around for these two people.
Yeah.
Whereas this one, I think, leaves a much worse taste in your mouth.
Really? I feel like this movie, I feel like the thing I don't like about this movie is how optimistic it is.
Yeah, with the ending?
Yeah, because like as much as I love this movie, and I also love the ending of this movie, like I feel it fits, and I think it stands in stark contrast to the Valentine's Day speech that happens at the beginning, because it sort of pretends to be the anti-Valentine's Day movie. But it's also very much sort of like the end conversation, the final conversation between Joel and Clementine is that... really sort of hammers home that these two people are meant to be together, as far as I'm concerned. And that's why when she says, meet me in Montauk in his memories, he does meet her in Montauk the next day. And it's just sort of like, We mentioned Annie Hall earlier. There's a line towards the end of Annie Hall that I love, and it's Alvy says, "I guess some of us just need the eggs." This movie, Annie Hall sort of ends up, that's about why we continue to try and be in love. Eternal Sunshine sort of suggests that, you know, even though we will eventually get bored with these people, there is still the concept of the one that still exists. And I think that that's kind of weird and sort of stands in contrast to what I would expect the movie to say. And I think like the last shot of the movie of them, I don't know, frolicking in the snow that gets replayed three times while it fades to white. I think that's an amazing, gorgeous shot, but I do not agree with the sentiment in it, you know? Yeah. And I actually think it's a gorgeous ending. I love their conversation where they're like, well, I'll get bored with you eventually. And he's like, I know, let's just do it anyways. I think that's a really about the best rendering of this opinion that I don't, or this opinion that I don't share.
Okay.
I don't know. It's a movie I strongly disagree with that I adore entirely.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I don't know. My take is still kind of split. And I think that with that last shot, I think it is visually pleasing. And I think that kind of gives you the idea that it's supposed to be a happy ending. And I think that, you know, that last kind of speech talk they have where it kind of ends with laughing and them saying, somewhat reluctantly, okay, well, let's be together because that seems to be the way it always is.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's a deleted scene that I think kind of helps explain my point a little bit more, but I think with the ending just the way it is, this is clear enough. But I just want to bring up the scene. There was one scene where Clem, years down the road of the ending that we have in this movie, goes back to Lacuna to get her memory erased again, and you see her file, and it says she's been there dozens of times.
Yeah.
And it's always for Joel.
Yep.
And so, I don't know. I think there's a couple ways to look at it, and I think there's a positive way to look at this movie, that it's about, you know, the connections that people feel for each other, even people seemingly opposite as Joel and Clementine, that there's kind of a connection that's always there.
Mm-hmm.
And in a negative way, that same thing can be looked at as human beings are just capable of very dysfunctional, self-destructive relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And that we never really learn, even when things are so obviously bad, and that we fall into the same self-destructive, counterproductive cycles.
Yeah.
And, you know, you said earlier that, you know, oh, well, they end up together anyway, so it must be a positive thing. I think that there's tons of people who end up finding their way back to each other that it's a horrible relationship for.
That's fair. I believe that point.
Yeah. It's,
no, sorry.
I don't know. No, it just says, you know, I just think it ends with a way that, you know, a situation where you can look at it two ways, that, you know, no matter what the circumstances and, the, you know, the things like timing and where you are in your life and all these kinds of things that influence who you start a relationship, that despite all those things, there is someone out there that you're just going to find no matter what and end up with, and that mm-hmm. you're always going to care about them no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, at the same time, that's not necessarily a positive thing. And, you know, maybe even in this context that we get our memories wiped at Lacuna and you can't remember anything about the other person, that I think maybe this movie also says about relationships that we always remember the good things. And, you know, when a relationship ends, you dwell on all the negative things and say, you know, it's good that this was over. No matter who ended it, you focus on all the negative things. But as time passes and you're less actively focusing on the negative things, kind of the positive stuff comes back up to the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And you go back into those same routines that you know aren't really healthy for you. And so I think it leaves it kind of up to the viewer. I do think visually and small things like them laughing about it, you know, their conversation ending with seemingly happy laughter about a negative thing, or at least an ambivalent thing, it does kind of leave a more positive taste in your mouth. And I think that, you know, I agree with you in the sense that I think for what the rest of the movie says, that is a weirdly positive note for it to leave on.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I just think it can go either way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's a good movie if it gives you enough things to think about like that. But yeah, that's all.
No, I see where you're coming from, and I just sort of, I don't know, there's something about the ending of this movie that maybe the ending of this movie is much better than I thought, and the idea is that you know, you could take it two ways, and you've taken it one way and I've taken the other way, and maybe I'm more romantic than I thought. maybe that's how it is.
This might be the first time you've out-romanced me, for sure.
I suddenly want a kid. no, but while we're on the topic of the ending, we talked about the last shot being, you know, a short bit of them on the beach that replaced three times. And this is theoretically from a scene earlier on in the movie, probably about two thirds of the way in. Have you thought about the meaning of the beach? Because I feel like the house is fairly easy. Like, they're sort of like, quote unquote, building a home when you have a relationship. That's sort of a, I don't know, that seems to be a metaphor that if it isn't used constantly, feels like it's used constantly. That's sort of why there's this song called To Build a Home by Cinematic Orchestra that's in every wedding video ever made.
And we, to counterpoint it, we get the destruction of the home as their relationship ends.
Yeah. I love that scene. But did you have any sort of thinking about the beach? Because I also, there's another, like, I don't have an answer to this question I'm asking you, but it also seems to be the only place where we get sort of, maybe this sort of ties into the conversation we have, but that scene that I'm talking about, two thirds of the way through the movie, they just sort of show up on the beach in the winter, and Clementine wants to get him to the house, but he's sort of like, no, we have to go somewhere else, and he wants to escape to somewhere else to get away from Lacuna or Mirzwak, but we don't really have a defined place where that exists, and it just sort of looks almost like a purgatory. And just all the beach imagery that happens throughout the movie, there's multiple times throughout the movie where Joel wakes up in his bed and there's like a fence just like the, and sand next to his bed, a fence just like at the beach. And the talk about sand at the beginning, meet me in Montauk, how they keep coming back to this beach together. Maybe the relationship is sort of like purgatory to them. I don't know. I wonder if you have any thoughts on the beach imagery.
Yeah, I do. And I think particularly with the Frozen Charles, which isn't exactly a beach, but I mean, we see them cross from, you know, earth, soil, and onto the frozen water.
Yeah.
Or ice, as some people call it. I think, yeah, basically, it's just a lot of the beach stuff, I feel, is just because they're so opposite, and we have something as stable and solid as the earth, which, you know, is our go-to metaphor for solidity and, you know, firmness and things like that. Mm-hmm. And that's Joel. And we have something as wild, as unpredictable as the ocean, and that's Clem. And, you know, she's so impulsive and, you know, manic pixie dream girl and, you know, all over the place. And he loves that she's impulsive and fun sometimes, and then she hates that she's unpredictable and drunk and unreliable and things like that. And just as far as the opposites attract motif, I think the crazy ocean and the solid earth, where they meet, that's kind of where their relationship lives. Mm-hmm. And as far as the Frozen Charles is concerned, he is so apprehensive about going out on that water and going out on that ice, and he wants things to be solid and predictable, even to the point that they are boring. I mean, his journal is blank, and he seems to know that that's a problem, but he seems content to let that continue.
Yeah, his journal's blank because he ripped out the pages of Clementine that Clementine was involved in.
But I mean, he's just more interested in having a more mundane life than rolling the dice and have something be unpredictable. And that's something that we have in every relationship movie, with the crazy impulsive girl and the, you know, quieter, meek guy.
Yeah.
And his apprehension about going on the ice is his unwillingness to give into this relationship where he might be hurt. And if the ice cracks and he falls, literally not falls for Clem, but falls into Clem, which is the water under the ice. Yeah. It's, you know, moving and quick, and he doesn't know, you know, he can't see what it is. And those are his fears. And, you know, him out on the ice is important. That's why we see it so much. That's why it's the cover of the movie. That's why we see what looks like a crack on all the posters and things like that, yeah. is it's his fears that his feelings are going to get away from himself, and he is going to fall into that.
Yeah, and just to talk, you mentioned that, or I don't know if you mentioned that Clem falls on the ice, but towards the beginning of the movie, she falls on the ice. And towards the end of the movie, we sort of get a shot of her looking at her ass in the mirror, and there's a bruise there because, of course, that would hurt and you would bruise. And this is right before she gets the envelope back from Mary, who is Kirsten Dunst's character, saying that she has erased Joel from her memory. And I think the bruise is like this really nice moment as far as like a visual metaphor of what is to come. Like you have to deal with your repercussions for all the decisions you make. And and I like that. I like that little touch. And that's just something that, having seen this movie countless times, that I had never picked up on, that I liked. But and it's just sort of like Clem rushes into things, and then she has to deal with the stuff that comes from it, or avoid it by going to the Lacuna. Yeah.
Yes, or alcohol abuse, or the other ways that we see her deal with things that might not be the healthiest.
We've talked a lot about relationships. I want to talk about memory. And specifically the act of erasing somebody from your memory.
Should we touch on how this whole Lacuna idea makes no sense?
I figured it's implied.
Okay.
Yeah.
Moving on. Back to your point.
The movie wastes no time explaining it, because what's the point? You know, it's just wasting time away from the interesting things, right? Okay, first question. What would it take for someone to get you to, like, what would I have to do for you to want to erase me? Because we see it, people in the movie, like, someone erases their dog, someone seems to erase their bowling buddy. What would I have to do to make you erase me from your memory?
Smother that child that I gave you.
Okay, fair enough.
Because it was mine.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I don't know. It's such an absurd notion, and I mean, there's obviously the logical problems of it, like what happens to that time, and you could never really erase someone. I mean, I don't mean scientifically, but there's too much proof of anybody who's meant that much to you, there's too much proof of their existence that I think it's kind of a moot point to ever consider in real life. I think it's...
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Like, sorry, like you would have to get rid of your apartment to get this person out of your mind. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, there's so much you'd have to do, and just even before you live with someone, if your relationship's getting pretty heavy, you're seeing them, I'm guessing, 2 to 3 times a week, right? If not more.
Oh yeah.
You have so much time. You have so much time to explain of what you've been doing.
Yeah.
Like, you've lost so much time with no explanation if you were to just erase that.
Yeah. No. Exactly. But no, I think, and I guess the, yeah. No, and I also, I don't know, I'm kind of weirdly obsessed with memory, so it just seems like no, I want more memories. I don't want less. But I guess a question I have for you, who is the best person? Like, as a person, who is the best person in this movie? And, like, any character that we get more than 2 minutes with. You know, you can't just say Jane Addams' character or whatever. You know?
Morally?
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'm saying morally.
It's however many characters you want to count Ty for last.
Yeah. See, I think
there aren't good people. Maybe Elijah Wood's the worst.
Yes.
And then everybody else is a step above him. I guess Mark Ruffalo is bad through negligence, but negligent of doing something he probably shouldn't do anyway.
Yeah. No, I think Stan, Mark Ruffalo's character, is the only the only argument for somebody who isn't just an objectively bad person, I think.
Yeah, and he's never good. He's barely neutral, if that.
Yeah.
I think there's an argument to be made about whether what Kirsten Dunst, Mary, does about sending back all the tapes. I think there's an ethical debate to be had about that.
Mm-hmm.
Mirzwak, I guess he's pretty low down there too.
Yeah, he's profiting on something that I think would be worse for society than good. So I feel like, and almost objectively so. So I feel like there's a real problem there for me. But
and his relationship with Mary.
Oh, exactly. Just don't hire Mary again. Find her another job.
Yes.
You know, like,
although I do
step one, erase the person you're having an affair with memory. Step two, find her a job that is nowhere near you.
Don't have another affair with her.
Jesus.
I mean, we've talked about how interesting I do find all the stuff with Clem and Joel, but I think all the Lacuna storylines, the characters who work at Lacuna, I think all their storylines are really interesting and get overlooked a lot when people talk about this movie.
Oh, absolutely, because it's the easiest. I mean, it's
the kind of the most normal part that doesn't bear discussion because it's similar to other things.
Yeah, and most people, I mean, when given the opportunity to deal with romance and or the ethics of erasing somebody's memory, they're going to want to focus on the romance aspects. And also more of the movie is devoted to Joel and Clem as well. Mm-hmm. For a more romantic side. But I really like the Mary character specifically because that's the way, I don't know, that's the most, I don't know, it's just, it's kind of like what we see with Joel, but we don't get a real in-depth examination of Mary's feelings. I really like that she finds out she has erased somebody from her memory and is shocked about it. And for some reason, that her finding out is more interesting to me than Joel finding out Clementine has erased him. I have no idea why, but I feel like maybe it's just because she's in this sort of position of power to change things because she actually understands the procedure as much as one can. But no, I find her really interesting, and I feel like the ending with her and Mira Zwiak and Stan, I feel like really adds a lot to the movie just because it's sort of, we're dealing with so much crazy shit being in Joel's memory for so much of the movie that is what grounds us and sort of reminds us, oh, this is a real thing. Like, theoretically in this movie, this is actually a thing that's happening. All this crazy imagery is happening in Joel's mind, you know? And then we sort of see the effect of that on a person eventually.
It's so out there. And we do get kind of a few moments of Joel and Clem having knowledge of this procedure and kind of dealing with what that means. But with Mary, yeah, we kind of see her as someone we didn't really expect to be involved in this process in that way. Mm-hmm. We saw her as someone who helps facilitate it, but it's so long into this movie before she realizes that, or even we realize that she's been a victim or a patient or however you want to phrase it of this procedure.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's what's interesting is that obviously, we don't know about Lacuna right when this movie starts, but we kind of get that Joel and Clem are involved in it somehow, or I mean, have undergone the procedure. And so to get this deep into it and then it's realized it's happened to Mary, it really hits you over the head that, yes, if this was a real thing, you wouldn't know and you wouldn't know about other people and you would be so in the dark about it. And
yeah,
that is what this procedure is and what makes it.
Mm-hmm.
But this is how drastic what we're talking about is this whole time. And yeah, I mean, we kind of get an idea of the scope of it as they're running around in Joel's head. But I find with Mary and Mira Zwiak, that's because it's so late, I think it really adds to the impact of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
So speaking of trying to ground this movie,
yeah,
which it could use, there's not tons of narrative progression for these characters.
No, and it's weird. I never actually thought about how much time until I started researching this podcast. I never thought about how much actual time passes in this movie. It feels like a shit ton because we're sort of like reliving 3 years, theoretically, of Joel, three years of Joel's life.
We get to see him as a kid and things like that.
Yeah, that's true. But it all takes place 3 days in 3 days tops. And we're only getting bits of most of those days, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just so much happens in such a small time. And again, it's all in the mind, but I like that. I don't know. I always like when a movie can feel like it takes way more time than it does.
Yeah.
I have no cogent way to explain why, but.
Yeah. And I like that moment early on, which is much more enjoyable the second time around when, what's Elijah Wood's character's name? Stan.
Patrick,
of course. I still don't understand that part.
It's just weird shit happening in his mind, you know?
Okay. when Patrick meets, or not meets, but confronts Joel in the parking lot out front of Clem's place.
Yeah.
It's like, what are you doing here? Can I help you?
Yeah.
That part I like a lot.
Yep.
But yeah, there's not tons of progression. I mean that in the sense that because it's all over the place, there are only a few, as you said, it's 3 days and we only get bits and pieces of those 3 days. And a lot of it is in his mind, in his memory, dealing with things that never really took place. Clem and Joel are considering what's happening in their future as they travel backwards in his mind. So, mm-hmm. I mean, we do have, things are moving forward. I mean, these aren't all entirely flashbacks because we see them deal with things as they progress. You know, they're like, that idea didn't work. Let's do this. Let's do this. I mean, things are moving forward, but in such a bizarre, abstract way that, you know, it's not like the character arcs we're used to.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I mean, I'm sure this is something I've mentioned on the podcast. I'm always, you know, if you can give me either plot or interesting themes that, you know, are kind of sort of plotless or not plotless, but don't move along in a sort of straight narrative or something, always give me themes, because, you know, that's always just more interesting to think about. And I feel like what this movie, I don't know, maybe lacks in traditional storytelling in a way that sort of, I don't know, maybe hinders the movie to an extent. It more than makes up with for being extremely interesting. And yeah, it's just sort of like, it's a fun movie to just put on and think about, you know, like, I don't know. I'm just having a bad, I'm doing a horrible job explaining these things I'm thinking.
It's as fragmented as their memory.
Yeah, exactly. There it is.
Well, no, what I was going to ask is, like, do you still feel that this movie, and I think I know your answer, but do you still think it's able to find an emotional center being this splintered and does not having a typical story arc? This is one that I think is, I'm more curious about or less certain of your answer. When it doesn't have a typical story arc, does that make it harder to ground and still find an emotional center? Like, do we get a better sense of these characters with this wonky timeline? Or because in real life, we're so used to, you know, A, B, C, D, things happening in a very specific order, does that make it harder? And just one more thing. We've talked about 500 Days of Summer and Annie Hall, and how those are kind of all over the place. And I remember specifically in the 500 Days of Summer podcast, you saying this movie is so all over the place because that's how we remember relationships. And mm-hmm. when you think about someone who is, you know, is not a part of your life anymore, you don't think, oh, I remember the day that I met them, and then I remember a first date, and then I remember meeting their parents, and then I remember this, and then I remember this. It kind of all hits you together, or whatever is the most pertinent at the time, or whatever the most emotional thing is. So do you think that kind of this splintered kind of storytelling is easier? Like, it's easier to hit you on an emotional level this way because that's how your memory works? Or do you think it's harder because that's not how our life really works?
I think it can go either way. I feel like it's easier to have an emotional resonance if you stay in sort of a realm we recognize, in a world we recognize. But there's a higher chance that, you know, if you swing for the fences and go crazy with Eternal Sunshine, the viewer might not see their world in it, but they'll see a fragment of their world put into this crazy thing that ends up making them think something bigger about their own life than the sort of realistic narrative would. And I feel like the potential for a more emotional reaction is always in the movie, like Eternal Sunshine, than say The Notebook, which is a more straightforward narrative and really gets its emotion out of realism from what I know. You know what
That's
I mean?
That's the only straight thing about it. We can cut that.
I don't want to edit this podcast.
You shouldn't have invited me then.
Oh, all right. Woman hater.
Nicholas Sparks hater.
Yeah, no, you derailed me, but no, I think you or at least for a person like me, I feel like you have a better chance of getting a good, like, a, you know, sort of a real emotional attachment to a movie from this type of thing, because I don't know, I like thinking about things more than I like being told things, and I do feel like that might not necessarily apply to everybody, but I feel like it applies to more people than are conscious of it. And yeah, I feel like it definitely applies here.
Okay. Yeah. So
how do you feel about that?
About the,
same question.
Yeah, I think it's tough. And I think it's more that the movies that are like that, as you said, I think are a bit more ambitious. And I'm sure you could show me some movies that try something like this and it fails miserably. Mm-hmm. And I think just kind of the best ones rise to the top. Like I liked 500 Days of Summer. I liked Annie Hall. I like this. I think these are just kind of good examples of something that isn't necessarily going to work, mm-hmm. but is just an ambitious thing that, as you said, when it does work, it works really well. And yeah. I think those two I brought up and this are just examples of it being really good. And I think you can make, you know, a straightforward narrative that hits you emotionally. Mm-hmm. But I think that because this is an interesting one, because it kind of catches you off guard going all over the place, it was just done well.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's a hard and fast rule that this is going to work. Mm-hmm. But I think it's harder, though. I think it's more difficult to do this one well properly.
Oh, yeah. I definitely agree.
Yeah. And so I think to still try something like this and still find an emotional center for these characters and still ground it in such a way that even though a lot of your mind is going to be focused on what the fuck is happening, there's like they still do enough things well enough for your mind to appreciate the things that this is doing well emotionally.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
I was one other movie I wanted to compare this to.
Okay.
And that would be Inception.
Okay.
And, you know, we talked about Memento a bit, another Christopher Nolan movie. Do you want to just compare how this movie deals with memory and imagination as a physical space compared to how Inception does? Because we see people kind of occupying their mind or someone else's mind as a geographical location.
Yeah.
In both of those movies.
This movie, I don't know, it's weird.
Okay, moving on.
No. I feel like in Inception, the character we are supposed to identify with the most is in control for more of the movie than he's not. Or at least that team is in control for more of the movie than they're not. At least in some capacity of this world. Whereas Joel, he's being, I guess we could call it, he's being chased by Mirswag. Whatever. Tom Wilkinson.
Carmine Falcone. If we're talking Nolan.
Yeah, I know. I don't know. In Eternal Sunshine, Joel is more sort of thrown into a position of the audience, whereas Ariadne, who is the character for the audience in Inception, is a more peripheral character. We're supposed to attach ourselves to Cobb, and Ariadne is there to explain things. In Eternal Sunshine, we are supposed to attach ourselves to Joel and then, I don't know, try and figure it out. You know what I mean?
No. You're right, though. He is on defense for this movie. And No, he is, and that's why I said, you know, just a couple minutes ago about spending a bunch of time wondering what the fuck is happening. We're on defense watching this movie. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think you're right about us being in his shoes and not in control.
Yeah. I think that's a good comparison. And as far as the way the worlds work, there's just more control going on in Inception. And, that's about
okay.
it.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I like that. And, I mean, I think it's this way for a reason in each movie, but I think the way that things break apart and the way that memories kind of flow into each other and, you know, collapse in on themselves and then are revealed to be another memory or something like that, I think that's better than the straight up levels we kind of get in Inception.
Yeah. And
I think that's more accurate to how our minds work. And I understand the narrative function for, you know, that premise in Inception.
Yeah. And they're aiming for totally different things. As far as financially.
Yeah,
as commercial entities. Yeah,
I just think, you know, the way we do kind of get a little bit of, I don't know, cross-contamination between worlds and memories and Inception is one way to put it.
Yeah.
Like, we see them be affected by rain and gravity and motion and things like that. But that is more of an action movie, and this is more of an, you know, emotional movie. And yeah, I think they both do the things they do on purpose and for a reason. I just think this one is kind of more accurate to how the mind works.
Yeah. No, I agree.
We think about things.
And that we don't have control over it.
Yeah, exactly.
Or it's a constant struggle to have control over it.
Yeah. So on that kind of note about the visual things, do you want to talk about more of the visual stuff?
This yeah,
is the part
sure.
Where I ask you to talk visuals and I go pee.
I really like the visuals in this movie. There's that one shot early on in the movie where Joel leaves Clem's apartment for the first time. And she like hangs out the window and says, call me when you get home or whatever, and wish me a happy Valentine's Day when you call. Just that shot of him with the street lights and it's snowing lightly and the music kicks in. Like that single shot makes me happier than any single shot in a movie should. Like it's like a throwaway joke if we're talking in comedy terms. It's just something that's there to fill time and get a point across, but it's like a very minor point. But I just think that that shot is just perfect and it just looks so natural. And that's sort of how I feel about this cinematography in this movie in general, because it's a very, very naturalistic style of cinematography. There's that shot of Kate Winslet or Clementine in the car after they get back from the frozen lake. Sorry, what was it called again?
Charles.
Frozen Charles.
I think it's the Charles River, but she always calls it the Frozen Charles.
Okay. And she's just lit entirely by the sun, but it's just such a, like a nice warm lighting. And I was reading an interview with Ellen Kuras. I don't know how to actually pronounce her last name, but it's spelled K-U-R-A-S. She's done a lot of documentary work, and Away We Go is another narrative film she was the DOP on. She was actually the DOP on No Direction Home, Martin Scorsese's Bob Dylan movie.
That's Blaze from Dylan.
Yeah, that's for you, James. but no, and Michel Gondry, the director, didn't want to do a lot of blocking or pre-rehearsal or anything like that. So they had to light for rooms. And Gondry also didn't want them to use like film lighting whenever possible. Gondry was like, no, you're not allowed to use lighting. You're only allowed to use what is already in this room. And I think that really comes across in the movie, and that always adds a natural feel to a movie. It's extraordinarily hard to pull off. And I think just the way nighttime is shot in this movie is so nice to me. And they just sort of use streetlights, but also sort of used, I forget what they used to sort of bump up the lights from the streets. But I don't know, that just the naturalistic feel, and it's all handheld and all lots of close-ups, and it's just a very warmly shot movie. And dealing with all the craziness that's going on, like the falling cars and stuff like that, like it's kind of a nice contrast to the insanity. But it's just a very warmly shot and warmly lit movie, in that it just had to use natural light a lot. One thing I do like about the visuals in this movie, and that tie into the theme of the movie, is that there's a lot of shallow focus used in the movie. Did you notice this? Where just a very small part of the screen is in focus.
Okay, yeah.
And we get a lot of these, like, shot you would think about would be sort of one of those shots. There's a few of them throughout the movie where part of most of Joel's face is like on the left of the frame, and then there's something just entirely out of focus next to him. Like, you can tell that his neighbor is there, but you can only tell that his neighbor is there because we saw him in the previous scene, basically. And it's
would just be a blur otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's just this type of focus is that there's so, and even on Joel's face, like there's soft focus on most of his face, and it's just sort of like this one point. And this happens all throughout the movie, in wide shots and close-ups. There's a much more shallow point of focus throughout a lot of this movie than the typical movie. And I think that's sort of meant to visualize how little of our memories that we have that we actually fully remember. Like, we remember the important part, the focus of the shot, but everything else just sort of blurs away. And I mean, that is part of, you know, the rules of photography, but the way focus or lack of focus is used in this movie is, it really emphasizes that the way things fade away from our memory. It's sort of like, I don't know, if you're walking you remember walking home with, you know, a former significant other or whatever. You remember maybe the route you walked. You don't remember necessarily what the trees looked like on that given day. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that that's really cool. And that sort of applies in the way the movie is cut as well. It's very fragmented and jaggedly edited movie. And I don't say that. It sounds like a negative, but I mean that entirely is positive. And it's just, things come and go seemingly at random. There's that scene where they're in the woods and that ends with Joel like dropping leaves on Clem when they're kissing. Like at one point in that scene, just a log just sort of lifts up a little bit behind them for no reason. And it's just sort of, I don't know, these things happening seemingly at random, but it just really backs up the unreliable nature of memory. And I love that. And the music backs this up as well. I mentioned John Bryan earlier. I love the theme from this movie. I love the music in this movie for the most part. And it's all, again, very sort of very jagged and cues end very suddenly. And it's just really good music, really good movie. And the way everything sort of ties together is really nice. And just, again, tying with the fragmentation, this isn't a visual thing, but Mary's quote book, her Bartlett's, it's a quote book. It's fragments of ideas and not the whole thing. And this is also somebody who we will find out has her memory erased. And I just think that was another nice little thing that they've thrown in the narrative that really, again, adds in to the feeling of how fragmented everything in this movie is and how fragmented our memories are.
Yeah, and one really small thing with Mary that I just noticed on rewatching, and it was something that I remembered but didn't make the connection until the last time through that I watched it, is when it's her and Mirzwak after he's showing up to try to fix Joel or get him back online or whatever after Stan lost him.
Yeah.
And we're aware of her kind of little girl crush on him, and she's trying to impress him with those quotes. And she says, "Oh, I know this quote from Pope Alexander." And he corrects her and says, "Alexander Pope." Mm-hmm. And we get the sense that about her, how unreliable her memory is. At this point, we're not even aware that she's ever undergone this procedure and at his hand. But I just thought that was a really nice moment where we get an idea that her memory is unreliable, but he knows the truth at the same time, which is something that, you know, we don't even get fully grasp that of until later. I mean, there's no chance we'd be able to get that on the first time around, but I always thought that was a nice one. And it ties in with her attraction to him, his kind of control that he has over it, his more complete knowledge of the situation. You're right, the way she thinks in quotes and the way that that's fragmented, it's also unreliable, and that this guy who holds the knowledge and technology to perform this procedure really has all the power and information.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. So we talked a little while ago about that scene where the house is coming apart.
Yes.
And you said you really liked it.
Quite a bit.
And there's a line where when he's walking away, she says, "Come back and make a goodbye. At least let's pretend we had one."
Mm-hmm.
Is this a positive sound you're making?
Yes, it is. Okay. A positive sound. I am smiling as I say that.
Okay. And we kind of talked about the notion of things being the way this movie can be good or bad. And there's a lot of ambivalence in this movie, and you can take what you want from it. Is this a movie about regrets? Or is it about, because just that line, I don't know, for some reason that always sticks with me, and it says, "Let's pretend we had one," and this is dealing so much with memory. Is this an attempt to really kind of control your memory and go back? And in this one, they're obviously eliminating it, but is it about, trying to control your memory and fix things that happened in it? Or is this movie about truly getting rid of those things? Because as we see by the way that they're compelled to get back together, they're never really eliminating these memories. They seem to just want to go through it again so they can fix it. And that the way that we see so much of this story is Joel going through his memories and, altering them. It seems to be a lot about going back and trying to fix things, even though ostensibly it's about getting rid of those things.
Yeah, I don't know that that scene is, I can definitely agree, is kind of about regret, at least kind of. But I don't know that I agree with the whole movie being about regret. He certainly regrets getting the procedure done by the halfway mark of the movie. And that's why he's running away. But it's not really about regret in a larger sense. It's sort of, he regrets some of the things he's done, but he's not really trying to change his memories. And he doesn't actually have the power to do that, it seems like. He's just sort of, he's got the power to be autonomous in memories that kind of already happened. And he can change them, but I feel like the memory still sort of stays the same. And this is like a new memory of when he was in his memory, changing it. Let's not get into that. But
So back to Inception.
I don't know. I would say the movie's about regret. It certainly is on some level. Anytime you're dealing with sort of a fractured love, regret will always come into it. But no, I don't see the movie as entirely about regret, you know, or just on a bigger plane. Like, I feel like it's a secondary theme, definitely. And certainly something that the movie would encourage you to think about. But I don't think it's like on the level of, you know, relationships and memory, which I think are the two big things in this movie.
Okay. Well, yeah, just going, you know, thinking about this movie and reading about it and just talking about it now, I just keep coming back to this point in my head of trying to fix things. And as much as this movie is about, as I said, getting rid of things, it's also so strongly about, I feel like, what you can't get rid of and things that stick with you.
Yeah.
And it comes back to that meet me in Montauk line, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it, the way that this memory, you know, cancel memory erasure procedure is explained in this movie, he shouldn't remember meet me in Montauk, right?
No, because just, I mean, that is a line where they have control, you know, they've become autonomous in Joel's memory. That line's not even a memory. That's his memory telling him to go to Montauk, or that's himself telling him to go to Montauk, or that is where you will find Clem. That's what that's sort of implying, because that's why the next day he goes to Montauk. He's not an impulsive person, but that's why he goes to Montauk, because an impulsive person told him to in his memory the night before. but
I mean, is it coming from his memory that somehow I don't know, outsmarted this scientific procedure, or is it something, you know, a sort of fate destiny thing that is making him compelled to go there?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's an interesting point. I think that sort of ties into, well, we'll tie it into the two things we've been talking about for the movie, relationships and memory. And I'll tie it into memory first. It's that one thing I really like about this movie is that scene where Clementine is talking about how when she was a kid, she thought she was ugly. She had a doll that she named Clementine and would yell at it for being ugly.
Yeah.
Apparently that was initially her reading a scene from The Velveteen Rabbit that also had the dialogue that is present in the movie, but they cut the Velveteen Rabbit scene for whatever reason. Or part for whatever reason. But the thing I liked about that scene is that Joel, it's almost like he forgot he had that memory, like a memory that possibly could have disappeared at any given moment and he wouldn't have realized, because it's just sort of like one of those things that, you know, as you age would just slowly fall out of your memory. You can only know so many things at one time.
Yeah, and it's not like, why can't I remember what happened on March 12th? It's just one of those things you don't even know you don't know anymore.
Exactly. And he, once he realizes that he's losing this thing that he possibly didn't even know he still had, he's like really attached to it. He's like, no, let me keep this one. And I thought that was really, really cool. And that's something that's totally unexplainable about memory, because it happens all the time. It happened to both of us today, probably, that we forgot something that we would like to remember, but just aren't aware that we forgot it. And I think that's sort of he's trying to hold on to something that he knows is disappearing. And I think that's sort of what the Meet Me in Montauk line is about as well. But now it's about Clem. And I have no explanation for the Meet Me in Montauk line or who has control in that situation. And I think that sort of ties into the point you used as an introduction, not me hating kids, but that love is kind of unexplainable. And I think that's still part of one of the main themes of this movie, is that love still is unexplainable, and it's weird and it's illogical. And this movie is more, I don't know, just encouraging you to think about it, not suggesting that you'll ever get an answer. You know what I mean? And I feel like that's how the Meet Me in Montauk scene strikes me, I guess.
Yeah, no, I think that's a part of it for everybody. And I think that's why that has so much emotional resonance.
It's also got an emotional resonance. It's Ken and Ruth's house.
No, I think that there is something we always like about this idea of human heart over science. And I think that, you know, with medicine and psychology and everything, we are trying to, in neurology, and, you know, again, like you said, it was something I brought up at the start. We're trying to quantify it and figure out everything. And we know now about what chemicals get released in your brain when you're with the person you love. And there's some, I don't know, it's not depressing, but it's, you can read about all these studies of, you know, just what endorphins and chemicals are in your brain when you meet someone you love for the first time versus what happens after a year. And, you know, the serotonin that gets released when you have an orgasm with the person you love and how that fades away, like, over the years. And it comes down to this very hard empirical science that, I guess depressing is the word for it. That when you have it all over, I mean, when you have it all in raw data like that, there's something about it that, you know, kind of feels you separate from something that makes you human, even though a desire to understand all these things is a very normal human feeling. But in this movie, we have a scientific procedure that is, you know, it's made up, but within the context of this movie, it is, you know, very scientific and has these proven results.
Yeah.
But I think we want to believe that there's something that is never going to be understood and quantified. Just as strongly as we want to understand and quantify everything, I think we all want something, or to believe that there is something that we're never going to be able to do that for.
Yeah.
And even in this one, if you take the negative view of it, that Joel and Clem are bad for each other and they're going to be in this endless cycle of codependence and self-destruction and, you know, hurting each other till they die. I think that we kind of get that. It's still ambivalent because at the end of it, there is that glimmer of hope that even if it's not a positive thing, there is something that's so powerful that it transcends scientific understanding somewhere in human nature.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I got nothing else. I feel like we've wrapped it all up. Put a little bow on it.
Okay.
Yeah. So thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Man. We'll be back. I'm not entirely sure what our topic is next week. It could be a couple of things. Could be about The Wire. Could be about Point Break. But
either way, it's going to be way more emotional than this one.
I get really emotional about Point Break.
Especially The Wire. There's an emotional show on TV.
I get really emotional about election week specials, all right? But no, and by the end of the year, we'll be doing an auteur podcast on the films of Quentin Tarantino. So that'll probably be the last podcast we run this year. And
QT!
Yes. Thanks, James. But yeah, be sure to check out our website, themacguffinman.com. Follow us on Twitter, at themacguffinman. If you're still listening, you would like to follow us on Twitter. And subscribe to us on iTunes. Rate us on iTunes. Again, we recommend 5 stars. But yeah, thank you for listening. And
follow my relationship podcast.
Yeah. James Gives Advice. It's a call-in podcast. So call that number. It's 1-800-JAMES-PODCAST. And yeah, he'll give you relationship advice. Unless you're a woman, in which case he'll just tell you how much he hates you.
And please support my James's Kid charity, where we keep babies out of the hands of Alex.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out our website, themacguffinmen.com, for supplementary links, articles, and more.